If you remember in the Day of Trumpets, I read Revelation 15, where it mentions that just before the seven last plagues, it actually mentions about the people of God singing the song of Moses and the song of the Lamb, these two songs. And if you, well, just turn back to Deuteronomy 31 and just remind ourselves of a few things. Because what I'd like to do today is to look at some of the changes that have taken place within our own countries, because the world is changing from what it was when I was a boy back in the 50s. There was an enormous change in the 60s when we came into the time of the 60s and the hippie generation, and the world is a very different place today. But it does say here in Deuteronomy 31, when it says, actually tells us who in fact wrote this song of Moses, in verse 19 it says, "Now therefore write you this song for you, and teach it to the children of Israel, and put it in their mouths, that this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel." So this was something that it was God himself, and Jesus Christ, who was the God of the Old Testament, who was actually talking to Moses from between the cherubim, presumably, at that time. And he gave him this song, and he wrote it down. And as it says in verse 29, it says, "For I know that after my death you will utterly corrupt yourselves." He knew, because of verse 16, God told him, "and turn aside from the way that I've commanded you, and evil will befall you in the latter days," notice, "because you will do evil in the sight of the Eternal to provoke him to anger through the work of your hands." So what Israel was going to be doing in the latter days was going to put, raise God, raise the one that became Jesus Christ, to anger. And what we're looking at today is we're looking at the fulfillment of this. And so although we've lived in this world, and we live in this world, and we exist within this world, and sometimes we can almost take the world for granted, it's not the way to God. I mean, he can see very clearly the time, for say the 50s, contrasted to the time that we are today. And I don't hold this 50s as being anything majorly righteous. That it says, "And Moses spoke to the ears of the congregation of Israel the words of this song until they were ended." And so the song was actually to tell Israel something. And it is interesting that, yes, he talks about the vengeance that he will have at the end of the song. He talks about the vengeance that he will have on the enemies of Israel. And so undoubtedly, when you're looking at the seven last plagues, you're looking at that element of the song being coming to the fore, because that was just about what was to happen. When the seven last plagues come along, that seventh trump, which comprises that seven last plagues, it is the revenge, or the vengeance, if you like, on the people that have actually persecuted and troubled Israel. But it does talk to Israel as well. In verse 28, notice, it says, "For they are a nation void of counsel, neither is there any understanding in them." Now remember, this is a song, so it's not strictly clear within the song who he's talking about. But when you read what it actually has to say, he's talking about Israel, certainly. But here it says, "Oh, that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end." And again, what's the song about? It's about Israel's latter end. And he says, "How should one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight?" And you go back into the wars that have happened, both in the beaches of Dunkirk, both in down in South Africa, the wars that have happened down there, and there have been numerous stories of actually the enemy seeing other armies that have been actually there defending Israel. That one should chase 1,000, two put 10,000 to flight, except their rock had sold them and the Eternal had shut them up. "For their rock is not our rock, even our enemies themselves, the judges. For their vine is the vine of Sodom," and so on. So it shows very clearly that God points them back to that, and they are therefore punished, and then God is going to go ahead and punish the punishers. If we turn over to Romans chapter 1, and again, trying to understand the news items that we read, and the change that has happened from what Israel was like, what Ephraim and Manasseh, who bear the name of Israel, were like those years ago, compared and contrasted with the way that they are today. In Romans chapter 1, we see the problems that, in fact, is a perverted mindset. It's talking to the Gentiles predominantly, to the Romans predominantly, in Romans 1, but it is a perverse mindset. And he lays out this perverse mindset and the fact that that perversion begins with the concept that there is no God. But he then goes into chapter 2, and notice in verse 8, because he's talking to the Jews initially in Romans 2, but then he goes in to verse 8 and he says, "Unto those that are contentious and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation, wrath, tribulation, anguish upon every soul of man that does evil, for the Jew first and also to the Gentile." Now that's what we're seeing for the end time. As we've been through the trumpets, we've seen that the problems that will actually occur. He says, "But glory, honour and peace to every man that works good." Notice that works good, that does good. "To the Jew first and also to the Gentile, for there's no respect of persons with God." And the thing is that when we look at the our nations in years gone by, if we go back a few hundred years, you find that there was a fear of God, although there wasn't the truth wasn't there, but there was a fear of God, and that in fact would need to be so, because God is not going to go ahead and compromise with his law. He's going to have to give some, let's read on. It says, "For as many as have sinned without the law shall perish without the law. And as many as have sinned in the law shall be judged by the law." So whether you know the law or whether you don't know the law, it doesn't make any difference. The law will take its toll. And it says, "For not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things that are contained in the law." In other words, should a Gentile nation decide to become righteous, decide to recognize certain righteous principles and apply those righteous principles, then these, it says, having not the law, are a law to themselves that shows the work of the law written in their hearts. In other words, what they're doing shows, that they are obedient to that law, even though they don't even know it, even though they don't even realize it. "Their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts, the meanwhile, accusing or else excusing one another." In other words, even just by having this innate, it's pretty logical. You don't steal from your neighbour. You don't lie to your neighbour. You don't commit adultery with your neighbour's wife. And these things, if these things are put in, you don't murder your neighbour. If these are put into place within a legal framework and a legal society, and they have, the concept of morality is being there from a pure human concept, then it will indeed accuse or excuse one another. They are able to make a judgment between certain problems that may arise. Now, what is happening today, however, you see in Romans 1, which is towards the Gentiles, and these concepts are then coming into Israel itself. This is the problem. And this is what is producing this latter end for Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh, is that they are taking on this kind of mindset. As it says in verse 18, it says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress truth in unrighteousness." And this is actually happening. And as you read the papers these days, you can see this frame of mind actually being applied and pressure being applied to, make the nation unrighteous. They are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest to them, is a better translation. "For God has shown it to them, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen," "being understood by the things that are made, even in his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." And he then goes on, talks how they're professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Now in the paper, there's one from today, and there's one, I believe, from yesterday. And we see this all the time within the paper. The one that yesterday says, "Fishy theory proved." Now it's proved. He says, "Fish that led Charles Darwin to question the theory of evolution have been found to fit his research perfectly. Darwin was troubled by flatfish such as flounders because it was unclear how the movement of one eye on the other side of their head could have come about. But a new study of fossils has revealed the intermediate stages as the creature's eyes changed." Now, I don't know. I haven't researched this particular incident at all, but there are basic and fundamental problems with all of these kind of so-called missing links. And that is that the problem with Darwin's theory is that if Darwin, you know, if the origin of species was by the natural selection, because of the survival of the fittest on every single case of breeding, which is what Darwin put forward, then what you would see if it was mutating from one species into another species is you would see this plethora of changed species. It's not just that you happen to come across a missing link and you say, oh, look at this wonderful missing link. That's not what he's on about. The problem that Darwin saw, and the problem, and the only way that he actually said that the solution to it, and the reason why it was the case, is that we hadn't looked long enough. Now, they've looked for 150 years, and the fossil record does not support Darwin. It is punctuated equilibrium. It is that you have huge amounts of unchanged equilibrium, punctuated by vast changes of creatures that come out of the middle of nowhere. That's the fossil record. And that is not the way that the fossil record should look according to Darwin's theory. It is not punctuated equilibrium. It is a gradual mutation. It's the survival of the fittest by the ones that are fittest being preserved on each reproductive stage, because the fittest obviously survive. And so this theory proved, what is it? I mean, the chances are it's a flatfish. You know what happens with a flatfish. Basically, it is a free-swimming fish with an eye on either side of its head, and then as it's a young fry. And then what then happens is that eye moves all the way across to the top of it, onto the other side. It turns onto its side and it lies flat on the bottom. Now, how do you get that? Now, if they found something like this, it could well be that the fry is a very large fry of a larger fish. Because, I mean, some of these flounders are absolutely huge, certainly over in Alaska and elsewhere. But another one that, this suppression of the truth in unrighteousness, you find another one, four-winged dinosaurs. This is one from today. Four-winged dinosaur may be the missing link in evolutionary theory. Newly discovered fossils of a four-winged dinosaur have been hailed as the, quote, missing link that finally proves that prehistoric creatures evolved into birds. The five fossils recently unearthed in China show an eagle-sized Jurassic dinosaur with feathers on its arms, legs, feet and tail. Paleontologists believe that the limbs would have developed into wings to enable the tiny predator to take to the skies. Now, if the tiny predator couldn't take to the skies, then what were the feathers there for? There's all kinds of question marks there. And as I say, it is not just the fact that you find a missing link somewhere, tucked in the middle of nowhere. It's the fact that you do not find the plethora of mutations that you would find if everything was evolving and changing by the survival of the fittest on every single reproductive cycle. That's the problem. That is the difficulty with Darwin's theory. The fossil record does not bear it out. It does not fit. And as I say, these things you find over and over again within the papers, and it is a case that the truth is being suppressed. It's being pushed out. You never find anything like that giving a creative slant ever in the papers that we see over here. Certainly not the Telegraph. Another one actually that appeared as well. That again, putting this constant drip feed. I think I'd rather get bored of immortality. You know, again, the concept is that this week Kurzweil pronounced that in 20 years nanotechnology will make us immortal. Because already blood-sized submarines called nanobots are being tested in animals, and he reckons that that'll solve the world's problems and you'll have immortality as a result of him. And she basically says that, no, I don't fancy living for 1,000 years. I think I'd rather die. So, okay, fine, we'll see whether that's the case as you get a bit older. Turn back with me to Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah chapter 1. Because in Israel today, there is a basic and a fundamental problem. As I said, you go back a few hundred years, or several decades, quite frankly, and you find a very different view of life. You find a view of life which had a respect for the Creator. And it was a view of life that respected the Creator of Scripture, of the Bible. And it was the Christian view, it was a Judeo-Christian heritage that was here within society. And it says here in Isaiah, verse 1, it says, "The vision of Isaiah the son of Amos, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem." It's interesting that when you're looking at Judah and Jerusalem, where Zion is, because an awful lot of this is about Zion, and it's where the Holy of Holies was at that time. But I want you to notice, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Now these kings were the kings that reigned in Judah for the lead up to the Assyrian captivity of Israel in the north. Israel in the north was taken captive in the time of Hezekiah. And at that time, the lead up, the things that happened leading up to that particular time of the captivity by Assyria of Israel, of which the physical Israel today is Ephraim and Manasseh, Britain and America, you're looking at this was the kings of Judah, the kings around the Holy of Holies at the time of the lead-up. And again, who is it being addressed to? It says, "Hear, O heavens, give ear, O earth, for the Eternal has spoken," the one that became Jesus Christ has spoken, "I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me." Remember what we read over in the Song of Moses about how can one put 100 to flight, or 10 put 1,000 to flight. It says, "The ox knows its owner, and the ass its master's crib. But Israel," and remember who is Israel, who has Israel marked on them, Ephraim and Manasseh, remember Israel crossed his hands as he put the blessing and said, "Let my name be named on them." "But Israel does not know, my people do not consider." This is the problem within the nations today. They don't see, they don't consider. "Our sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors." They are corruptors. They not only are corrupt, but they corrupt others around them. "They have forsaken the Eternal. They've provoked the Holy One of Israel to anger. They've gone away backwards." And as it says in verse 8, "The daughter of Zion is left as a cottage in a vineyard." In other words, we are becoming more and more, the true church is becoming more and more strange. It's almost like a cottage in a vineyard. As a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, it's something that sits up by itself that really doesn't fit within the entire surroundings. "As a besieged city, except the Eternal of Hosts left us a very small remnant, would have been as Sodom and had been like Gomorrah." This is the, again, who is it talking to? Well, just in Isaiah 2, it goes into and talks very clearly in an end time setting. It's an end time setting, using the situation of the first captivity by Assyria of Israel, looking down into the future, into the end time, when there will come again a captivity of Israel by Assyria. Now, the kind of things that we see in the news, this one it was from Monday. This is, there's one here, "Nurse fears sack over a crucifix. A nurse will meet hospital managers today to find out whether she will be forced out of her job for wearing a cross on duty. Shirley Chaplin has been taken off the wards at the Royal Devon and Exeter NHS Trust Hospital after refusing to remove her necklace. And it says that she's been told that the wearing of the one-inch cross openly breaches the uniform policy. And she's been told that she could be suspended if she doesn't cooperate or accept an administrative rule, prompting fears that she should be dismissed after nearly 30 years. So for 30 years, she's worn this, basically the icon of her religious beliefs. And that religious belief is Christian. And I say Christian in quotes, yes, we shouldn't be wearing crucifixes. I mean, that's not something that we should be wearing, because it doesn't actually come from the cross of Christ. It comes from the Tau symbol, going way, way back beyond the cross of Christ. Nevertheless, it indicates the pressure that is being put on the Christian ethos, the Christian thinking that we're finding in today's society. Another one said here, that Christians accused of offending Muslim face ruin. It says a Christian, this is all on the same page, a Christian couple faces losing their livelihood after being charged with a criminal offence for offending a Muslim woman by saying that Islamic dress was oppressive. Now, I believe that Islamic dress is oppressive. But the fact that they said it to her, it says, Ben and Sharon Wolfensang, I think it is, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it, are awaiting trial, accused of breaching public order by insulting a guest at their hotel in Liverpool over her religion. The couple, who are members of an evangelical congregation, were arrested by police after getting into a discussion with the woman about the differences between Christianity and Islam earlier this year. Mrs. Wolfensang, 54, was understood to have described Muslim dress as putting women into bondage, while her husband, 53, allegedly described the Prophet Muhammad as a warlord. Now, all you've got to do is to go and read the history. He was a lord in the area, and he did make war, so he was a warlord. It is understood that the couple's business, the Bounty House Hotel, has suffered a significant drop in takings because of the case. Friend said bookings had fallen by up to 80% after a local hospital ended an arrangement by which it recommended the hotel to people attending courses there after hearing that the owners were facing criminal charges. So the repercussions from this are huge. And we do see this, and we see this continually. Another one, which is right underneath it, says civil servants told to respect Ramadan fasting. It says Home Office staff have been told not to eat in front of Muslim colleagues during the religious season of Ramadan. A 5-page advice booklet urges civil service to take care where they eat, and the Home Office Islamic Network produced the advice, which says please be sensitive when eating lunch and so on during the time of fast. Now, have they got a book there that says that you've got to be careful about what you eat on atonement? Is there anything like that? I don't see that at all. But I want you to notice that this kind of thing would never have appeared, you know, 50 years ago, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. You just simply wouldn't have that. It was a Christian nation. And what is happening today is that it is definitely trying to make sure that the nation is anything but Christian, anything but adhering to the Judeo-Christian heritage that they had. Now, I agree that Judeo-Christian heritage wasn't correct, but as we've just read in Romans, if you apply a certain proportion of it, then you're blessed by that proportion. And this is what we see today being eroded. Another one that somebody sent me an article in the week, and it had a link to this particular article, which is from about a year ago that this took place over in America. And I tried to find out what the results of this particular court case was. I couldn't find the results of it. But it says a Michigan man is seeking $70 million from two Christian publishers for emotional distress and mental instability he received during the past 20 years from versions of the Bible that refer to homosexuality as a sin. It says, Bradley Fowler, a gay man, claims his constitutional rights were infringed upon by Zondervan Publishing Company and Thomas Nelson Publishing, which are the ones that produce these Bibles, both of which he claimed deliberately caused homosexuals to suffer by a mistranslation of the Bible. Seeking $60 million from Zondervan and another $10 million from Thomas Nelson. According to a USA Today report, Fowler's two separate suits against the publishers claim the intent of the Bible revisions that refer to homosexuals as sinners reflect an individual opinion or a group's conclusion. Fowler says that the deliberate change made to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 9 caused him or anyone who is a homosexual to endure verbal abuse, discrimination, episodes of hate and physical violence, including murder. If you want to just out of interest, turn over to 1 Corinthians 6, verse 9 and just see what he's actually talking about. But it says in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 9, it says, "Don't you know that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Don't be deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor," and it gives then the two forms of homosexuality, "the effeminate," which is the one form, "nor abusers of themselves of mankind," which is the other form, the male form. You're looking at the two male forms. One is an effeminate, the other one is abusing themselves with mankind. And it's very clear from that. You put that into the context of all of Scripture, there is no confusion whatsoever, none at all, regarding what that verse is talking about. You've got to twist the verse to get any other conclusion. But it says Fowler, who represented himself in both, was representing himself in both lawsuits, claimed that publishers are misinterpreting the Bible by specifically using the word homosexuals, which made him an outcast from his family and contributed to physical discomfort and periods of demoralization, chaos, and bewilderment. So that, again, this would never see the light of day. And yet it says at the end, it says U.S. District Judge Alan Abel Cook Jr., who will hear Fowler's case against Thomas Nelson, says the court, quote, has some very genuine concerns about the nature and efficacy of Fowler's claims. In other words, he looks at the claims being made, and obviously if he didn't have any genuine concerns, he would have thrown the thing out. But the judge obviously has some doubts about it, about how this verse is translated. Again, If you look at it in its context, there's absolutely no doubt in anybody's real mind as to what it actually means. The final scripture, just turn over to Jeremiah 2. Because here in Jeremiah 2, and again it's addressed not to the house of Judah, but it says in verse 4, "Hear you the word of the Eternal, O house of Jacob, and all the families of the house of Israel." Now he uses the word Jacob when he's talking about Israel in a negative light. I remember, my name be named on them. So the name of Jacob goes on Ephraim and Manasseh, Britain and America, but it's also, and Israel as a whole, obviously, but it's also the house of Israel is being referred to as well. And in verse 11 it says, "Has a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit." What they had in the past, the secret of England's greatness, was indeed their glory. It was this book. It was the principles out of this book that inadvertently, almost, they applied. And yet, today that is not the case. It says, "Be astonished, O heavens, at this. Be horribly afraid, for be you very desolate, says the Eternal. For my people have committed two evils. They've both forsaken me as the fountain of living waters," in other words, the word that was given to them that allowed them to have a certain spiritual understanding, if you like. Even though they were a carnal people, they still had a spiritual understanding that was given almost by inference, by putting into effect some of the principles. And yet, on the other hand, and this is the problem today, they've hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. Their concepts are defunct. They're morally bereft. And this is the problem that we see continually throughout the newspapers, and it's something that we need to make sure that as we read the news, we keep in mind, we keep an understanding, and understand that the problems are spiritual problems within the news today. And as we read the news, we read the problems that are there, they are coming invariably from a spiritual source.